From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Callum Borchers. It's Here and Now. Today we're observing Juneteenth, the new federal holiday commemorating the end of slavery in the U.S. It was signed into law by President Biden, who at a ceremony Thursday declined to answer this question from a reporter.
Mr. President, is Election Day next? Is the plan to sign Election Day a national holiday?
Making Election Day a federal holiday may actually come up for debate next week. That's when the Senate is expected to vote on a sweeping bill to expand national voter registration and voting access, which Democrats say is their highest priority. Our Friday Politics Roundtable joins us now. We have Margaret Talov, who is managing editor at Axios, and Scott Wong, who is a staff writer at The Hill. Hello to you both.
Hi, Tanya. Hi, Colin. Great to be with you.
Happy Friday. So, Margaret, remind us, why do Democrats say this is their highest priority, and what changes do they want to see in elections?
I mean, you need look no further than the 2020 elections to understand how crucial turnout and making it easier for turnout is to people. The pandemic had the sort of counterintuitive effect of forcing many states to quickly move to give people more flexibility in voting. And look what happened. And boy, it was a squeaker. And that answers the other question, why don't Republicans want this? So S1 is the big sweeping overall arching voting rights expansion and reform bill that we've been hearing about for months. That's the For the People Act. It's clear there's not bipartisan support for it. But where this has taken a turn in recent days is that Joe Manchin, the senator from West Virginia, who is a Democrat but confounds all Democrats by blocking many of the things that they want to do, had said that he could support a kind of a scaled-back compromise that would still greatly expand and cement national protections for voting, including making Election Day a holiday, including, you know, 2 weeks of minimum early voting. And that is now where we stand. Republicans say no way. And Democrats say you have to do it. There's no excuse not to do it.
Let's get into the Joe Manchin situation in just a moment. But first, I want to talk about and bring in Scott Wong here. Republicans lined up at a press conference yesterday to take aim at this. Here's John Barrasso of Wyoming.
The more people find out about this, the less they like it. It is radical. It's extreme. It is dangerous. It is scary.
In particular, Republicans don't like a provision to set up independent commissions to draw new maps for congressional seats. Scott, why is that one of their biggest criticisms of this bill?
Well, I think that, traditionally there had been, state legislatures that had drawn congressional district maps every 10 years or so. And, those debates and those fights get very partisan. And, when Republicans control legislatures, which they control most of them in the country, though, that tends to favor Republicans. And so they don't want to see these changes. I mean, one of the proposals that Joe Manchin is proposing in his scaled back plan is to ban partisan gerrymandering and to rely more on computer models to draw these congressional districts, which would be much more fair. You wouldn't see these really strangely shaped congressional districts that we've seen these maps of in recent decades. And so that's just one provision that Manchin's looking at. The other would make, as you mentioned earlier, making Election Day a public holiday. Still others would mandate at least 15 consecutive days of early voting for federal elections. So there's actually a lot for Democrats to like here in the scaled back Manchin plan. I think the big question is, could he bring on a lot of the progressives that are really gung-ho in pushing for the For the People Act that had passed the House earlier?
Well, Scott, that is such an important question. Can Joe Manchin rally support to what he's trying to build as kind of this compromise proposal? And it did get a boost of support yesterday when the very prominent voting rights advocate Stacey Abrams endorsed it on CNN. Here she is.
What Senator Manchin is putting forward are some basic building blocks that we need to ensure that democracy is accessible no matter your geography.
So, Margaret, help handicap us now. There's some of what Manchin is proposing. Stacey Abrams says it's good building blocks. Is that going to be enough to rally the support that it would need to pass?
Yeah, this is where understanding those rules and procedures of the Senate, really comes in handy, because unlike the infrastructure debate where you can talk about budget reconciliation and 51 votes and all that kind of stuff, like, this is a voting rights bill. You got to change. You got to either eliminate the filibuster, which Manchin has said he's not going to do, or water down the filibuster, which Manchin has certainly not committed to doing, or find a bunch of Republicans to cross party lines and say, yes, it would be the right thing to make it easier for poor people and people of color to vote. Okay. And right now they don't have it. So right now, this is looking very much like a test vote where Democrats can prove that Republicans don't really want voter reforms. And then where do they go? And this is all going to come down to a wire ahead of midterms, where Democrats have the barest of bare majorities in the Senate, needing the vice president and unanimity to break a logjam, and a very razor thin majority in the House as well. Republicans in the Senate and the House both want to be able to try to take back control of both chambers of Congress. And they think that expanding these voting rights, particularly in red states, and overriding what legislatures in red states want to do is going to hurt them. And this could make a decade's worth of difference in the balance of power across the United States, in state legislatures, in governor's mansions, as well as in Congress. That's why it's being so heavily fought.
Sure. And Margaret, you drew the comparison a moment ago to the infrastructure debate. And let's go there next, because the Senate Budget Committee Chair Bernie Sanders is now floating a $6 trillion infrastructure plan, which would go even farther than the president's. It includes a plan to lower the eligibility for Medicare to age 60, possibly even immigration reform tucked in there as well. Scott, is a $6 trillion infrastructure plan realistic at this point?
I think realistically, it would have to be scaled back. I think that is sort of the dream for progressives, to a $6 trillion plan. I mentioned it to a couple moderates in the halls of Congress this week, and I got a couple of eye rolls. This goes back to the same dynamic with all of these issues that we're seeing. Progressives and moderates sort of struggling for power, trying to influence the path forward for the Biden agenda. And we're seeing it, up close and personal with infrastructure. On the one hand, you are seeing this plan being put forth by Bernie Sanders and progressives in the face of Biden walking away from those bipartisan talks with Shelley Moore Capito the other day. But at the same time, you are seeing some more momentum from the centrist. Now we're seeing, I think it was 21 members of Congress, 11 Republicans and 10 Democrats, who are saying, we want to move forward on a smaller scale back bipartisan talks. And so, there really is a power struggle happening between the centrists and the progressives on the Biden agenda.
Yeah, those 11 Republicans have actually signed on to this narrower compromise that totals about $1 trillion. I want to talk with you guys, with a little bit of time, though, that we have left, about President Biden's overseas trip. He has just returned. His main message to foreign leaders is America is back. House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy and Biden said Biden gave Russian President Vladimir Putin a pass on issues like cyber attacks. Biden's National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan actually pushed back against criticisms like that. Let's listen.
I just don't buy the argument which says this was not worth it for the United States. As President Biden himself said, he did what he came to do, and I think America's come out better for it.
That was Sullivan on CNN. Biden came away with the first mention of China in a NATO meeting and a new arms dialogue with Russia. Will what happened this week in Geneva have a lasting effect, Margaret?
I think we don't know precisely what effect it's going to have. Biden himself said he thinks it'll be 6 months to a year until, but the President Biden and his team didn't really feel like they had any choice but to do this and to do it in a very measured way that was not aimed at making headlines or getting into a power struggle with Putin, but just to say that Helsinki 2018 or Trump's general handling of Russia could not be kind of the standing U.S. position vis-a-vis Russia, that Biden is trying to usher in a new era in terms of positioning and rhetoric. And he had to come there and say to Putin and to the American audience, which is always what foreign policy trips are also about, to say out loud, these are my red lines. There's a new sheriff in town. This is how it's going to change. Now that he's back home, I think it's some of the attention is going to move away from Russia and in the immediate days, much more towards Iran. You've got the elections in Iran, a new president, all but secured to be this hardline judicial cleric, and real concerns in the U.S. about a closing window to try to put back together some version of the Iranian nuclear deal. But these longer term discussions with Russia over whether there can be a nuclear agreement, what's going on in the Levant in the Middle East, these are all going to begin to proceed to move forward with cyber very much hanging over all of us.
Margaret Tolove is managing editor at Axios, and Scott Wong is a senior staff writer at The Hill. As always, thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Millions of Americans have the day off in observance of the first ever Juneteenth National Independence Day. President Biden signed the bill Thursday establishing the new holiday, which commemorates the day in 1865 when Union troops told enslaved Black Americans in Galveston, Texas, that the Civil War had ended and they were free. Let's listen to a bit of Vice President Kamala Harris's remarks yesterday at the signing ceremony in the White House.
And still, let us also remember that day was not the end of slavery in America. The truth is, it would be six more months before the 13th Amendment was ratified, before enslaved people in the South and the North were free. So as we commemorate the history of Juneteenth, as we did just weeks ago with the history of the Tulsa race massacre, we must learn from our history. And we must teach our children our history, because it is part of our history as a nation. It is part of American history.
And on this Juneteenth weekend, we turn to a book that illuminates a previously little-known piece of history. It's called Wake, The Hidden History of Women-Led Slave Revolts, and it's part memoir, part research text, packaged up in a graphic novel. Author Rebecca Hall is a scholar in residence at the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture in Harlem, and she joins me now. Rebecca, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Let's talk about this hidden history that you uncovered. People may be familiar with Nat Turner's Rebellion or the Stono Rebellion, led by a man named Jemmy. What did you find about lesser-known slave revolts led by women, and how did you even know to look in the first place?
Yeah, so when I was in graduate school, I began to study slave resistance, and I wanted to focus on the topic of revolt. Almost every book or article that I picked up said somewhere within the first 20 pages or so, you know, this was an activity that women didn't participate in. And that struck me, because it's a little bit like waving a red flag in front of a bull for me, because I was curious about, like, what's happening here? And I went to the primary sources and found women actually involved in slave revolt.
You know, I mentioned at the top that this book is part research text. It actually began as your doctoral dissertation. I don't know many dissertations, Rebecca, that have become graphic novels. So how did that come about? And is the idea, I wonder, to make it more approachable for a broader audience than perhaps putting it in a textbook?
I didn't want it to be stuck behind the academic curtain, you know, where maybe 10 history graduate students have, you know, read it. The graphic novel format, you know, it makes it more accessible, but it's not at all a dumbing down of a material. Like, the graphic novel is a medium that allows one to do things that you can't do in other mediums. Like, there's this linear text combined with a all at once art, and like a combination of those things allowed me to put the past right juxtaposed with the present. But then I had to find an artist because I can't even draw stick figures.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that because, of course, it does require powerful imagery. So we'd be remiss if we didn't mention the terrific work of Hugo Martinez, your illustrator collaborator. And some of the most powerful images, by the way, include you. In fact, the process of your doctoral research is part of the plot of this book. You're a character in your own book. Mm-hmm. Why did you choose to approach it that way?
Yeah, that was not my intent. When I decided I was going to do this. But I needed to insert myself first as a narrator. A lot of the primary sources that I'm dealing with are kind of fragmentary, and you have to read them sort of against the grain. So I needed to be able to explain that process to readers. And as I was writing it, it became clear that I needed to talk about my personal investment. So it ends up becoming this story within a story where me, the granddaughter of slaves, you know, it tells the story about me living in the wake or the afterlife of slavery. It also tells the story about these women in revolt, and it talks about the process of excavating their history.
Many of these rebellions were not only on land after people had been brought to the U.S. In fact, many occurred during the Middle Passage on ships. And furthermore, you discovered that there was a correlation. The more women on board a slave ship, the more likely a revolt. Now, this was a data point some historians had noticed before, but previously dismissed as kind of a fluke. What did you find about why that actually was the case?
What I found when looking at the captain's logs and surgeon's logs of ships that had revolts, when a ship left the coast of Africa, the women were brought from below and left unchained on the deck of the ship. So they had mobility, and they were also closer to weapons. I saw time and again women using that advantage to revolt.
The slave traders were consistently underestimating the women at their own peril, as it turned out.
Yeah, I mean, it was... I remember just thinking, like, well, this is a stupid business practice. Like, what? Aren't they getting it? But yeah, I mean, gender assumptions are very intense. And it's also kind of crazy because the documentation that is so meticulous, because they have to maintain the documentation because their slave ships are insured. And there are insurance policies that are specifically against what's called the insurrection of cargo, which is a term that is really intense because, you know, cargo doesn't insurrect. So that allowed me as a historian today to look at, you know, the details of these revolts, you know, as these ship captains and others documented them.
Yeah, the insurance element is dehumanizing in the extreme. I'm glad you mentioned it, though, because you had an interesting experience visiting Lloyd's of London, the insurance giant. Mm-hmm. They, of course, have internal private records, presumably going back for a long time. You would have loved to excavate that. But what happened mm-hmm. when you asked to see their records to try to learn more about the slave trade?
Their response is that this is a private corporate archive, and we don't allow researchers into the archive.
Has that changed at all? That was 20 years ago when you were working on your dissertation. We're in the middle of what everyone is calling a reckoning, right? I mean, are companies like Lloyd's of London actually doing the reckoning? Are they allowing greater access?
I'm just chuckling because I've had to get up to speed on what Lloyd's of London is up to lately. In January of last year, you know, they said that they were going to hire an archivist to work internally to see if some artifacts that they have are racist. And I don't care if they have racist artifacts. You know, for me, I want to uncover history and tell stories, and I need to see their insurance policies, how they insured the slave trade, in order to excavate this history.
You know, Rebecca, you said something a moment ago that sticks with me. You said, I want to tell stories, not just like summarize data, but individual people's stories. And one of the things that comes through in your book is there was a personal cost to doing that. I mean, you had to take long periods away from your family. This was very emotionally draining for you. Why was mm-hmm. it so important to you to persist?
I feel like if my immediate ancestors, you know, survived slavery, I could certainly research it. You know, I mean, it's not even comparable. And I think that the story needs to be told if you're young and you're learning, you know, that your ancestors were considered human property for hundreds of years, you can feel a lot of shame about that. So it's so important for people to, you know, to know your ancestors fought that every step of the way. So there's a way in which connecting the dots, you know, between past resistance and the present is a really kind of empowering act.
Well, as you're connecting those dots then, and you look at today's resistance, I wonder if, as you've studied how women were written out of the history of slave revolts, whether you see a parallel in today's Black Lives Matter movement. I'm thinking in particular of the refrain, "Say her name," which is a reminder that Black men are not the only victims of police violence.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, my understanding is that the "say her name" was an expression that was created specifically to talk about women being killed by police. And then it got used as like, say his name or say their name. And so the original people who were saying, no, we meant that to highlight the specific gendered nature of this, that women are also being killed. I think it's a lot harder to erase Black women's agency in the movement for Black lives. But I think you bring up a good point that there can be a way in which police violence directed at Black women can be erased or not discussed as much.
Rebecca, one more thing I'd love to ask you about is just the title of your book, starting with just that first word, wake. I think when I picked up the book, I took it as wake up to this hidden history. And that may be part of it, but you explain deep into your book that there's actually a second meaning. It also can refer to a wake, as in a wake that you have for the dead before a funeral. Could you explain that and why you chose that?
Yeah, I mean, the term wake actually has kind of multiple valences. I was thinking about living in the wake of a ship, like a slave ship, and also living in the wake of slavery, and also, you know, as you pointed out, a wake for the dead. So a process of honoring the dead.
Well, you're honoring the dead and you're bringing their stories back to life. And thank you for spending some time with us. Rebecca Hall's new book is called Wake, The Hidden History of Women-Led Slave Revolts. Rebecca, thank you so much.
Thank you.
On NPR's Rough Translation,
there's just fewer people that know somebody that's in the military.
After 20 years of war, are civilians and military farther apart than ever?
They were asking me, do you want to hear this? Do you want to know us?
Listen to Homefront, the new season of Rough Translation.
Are you thinking about quitting your job? You're not alone. The pandemic is forcing a lot of Americans to rethink their work, despite the economic turmoil of the past year. According to the latest figures from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, 4 million Americans quit their jobs in April alone. That's the highest level since the agency started publishing those numbers in the year 2000. Let's bring in Mike Regan, senior editor for Bloomberg News. Mike, the data suggests people are looking to do something different from what they did before the pandemic. Now, obviously, there can be many reasons why people quit. So let's run down some of them. What's going on here?
Yeah, right, Calum. Well, and it is one of those situations where we just have the numbers and not a ton of sort of hard, tangible evidence to explain why it's happening. But anecdotally, there are a few themes that keep popping up. For example, the Washington Post interviewed several people who quit their jobs. And one common theme is that the virus lockdowns have left a lot of people with more free time on their hands to sort of, I don't know, stop and smell the roses a bit and kind of re-examine their priorities in life. And that's inspired some people to, say, take a stab at entrepreneurship and go out on their own or otherwise just completely shift lanes career-wise. And one other thing I'd point out, I was talking to our chief U.S. economist at Bloomberg about this, and she's hearing a lot about people who are simply quitting jobs because their employers are demanding that they return to the office. And I think a lot of people, Calum, realized during this pandemic they enjoy working at home a lot more than going back to the office. So that's certainly playing a role.
Sure, maybe looking for jobs that'll let them keep working from home. And I will say, Mike, I mean, the term quit can have a negative connotation, but people leaving their jobs voluntarily suggests they're confident that either they can find new work or maybe they'll be able to afford not having one for some time. So could this actually be a good sign for the economy?
So you're right. In the abstract, it usually is a good sign if people feel confident enough to quit a job. I do think this situation is unique, though, because of all the sort of extraordinary government actions taken last year, such as the moratorium on evictions and limits on mortgage foreclosures and the pause in federal student loan payments. Those things likely gave some people the sort of wherewithal to be able to quit a job and take on that risk. But you got to remember, though, that eviction moratorium and the foreclosure moratorium, they actually expire at the end of this month. So next few weeks, I think that's going to be a sort of an important pain point in the economy to keep an eye on is how that affects people, because there are millions of people affected by those programs, Colin.
Sure. And let's not forget, there are still more than 9 million people who are unemployed and looking for work. So in the moment we have left, Mike, what does the labor market look like for them right now?
Well, it's on the flip side of that, there's actually a record number of job openings at more than 9 million. But I think of it as kind of like when you reboot a computer. You know, we shut down and rebooted such a huge part of the economy. Like a computer, takes a while to get it up and running again. So I think we got to sort of wait and see and allow these job seekers and the job openings to find each other.
All right. That's Mike Regan, senior editor for Bloomberg News. Mike, thanks as always.
Thank you, Colin.
And if you're listening out there and you have quit your job, or you're thinking about quitting because your workplace wants you back in the office full time, as Mike said, and you want to keep working from home, we'd love to hear from you. Tell us your story at hereandnow.org. You can fill out our questionnaire, or you can email us. The address is letters@hereandnow.org.
You know, something so characteristically human and American happened a few days ago. 52,000 people stood sweaty, shoulder to shoulder, in 80-degree weather to watch on their home turf the seventh-inning satisfaction of Mookie Betts hitting a home run, the Dodgers beating the Phillies 5-3.
Fly ball, left center field, way back there!
Dodger Stadium on Tuesday was essentially California's largest experiment, testing the effectiveness of the state's vaccination efforts to curb a disease that has killed more than 62,000 people here in the state. It wasn't too long ago that the stadium was used as a mass COVID-19 vaccination site. But with more than 70% of adults in California having received at least one dose of the vaccine, this reopening day, as the Dodgers call it, was kind of like a reward after a year of fear, loss, and isolation.
I think I call it the bizarro world of baseball, and really the twilight zone of baseball, too.
This day was certainly a reward for Tim Neverett. He's one of the official Dodger announcers, and for the last year and a half, he's been calling games overlooking an empty stadium of cardboard cutouts.
When you look at the cardboard cutouts, we saw them differently. We saw the back of them, which were all white. So to us, it just looked like rows and rows of white tombstones.
The weight of this analogy is not lost on Neverett. The empty seats were a reminder of the tremendous losses. This whole experience has even made him more philosophical about being the voice of the Dodgers.
You're that friend that they don't really know, but they know. And you help get them through a long drive, or you help get them through a project at home while they're working, or maybe they're just sitting on the porch enjoying a beverage listening to the game. I mean, you're that person that takes them on the baseball journey that night. And I enjoy being that person in the middle. You know, people say get rid of the middleman, but no, this middleman is in a good spot. I like being in that position and telling the story on a nightly basis.
Neverett and everyone here, from the ushers to the cleaning crews and parking attendants, they all play a part in fulfilling that game day experience. At the start of the season, the Dodgers were limited to 25% capacity, and the mask mandate was still in place. Well, on this night, there are more smiles on display, crowds of people taking advantage of the state lifting almost all of its restrictions. And those smiles were fortifying for 20-year-old twin brothers Alex and Adam Handy. This is the first year they're on concessions. Working the stadium is in their blood. Their older brother worked here, and so did their dad back in the 80s.
Me and my brother, we've been, I wouldn't say shackled up, but we've been at home most of the time. We both actually got COVID. Yeah, so it kind of hit home a little bit. But it's nice to see everything sort of what it back to normal, you know?
Well, I mean, growing up, we were always, like, Dodger fans. So, and plus, like, my dad has been a Dodger fan. My whole family's Dodger fans. So it means a lot to us.
Waiting in the concession line were father and son, George Mickle the second and the third.
It means so much after waiting through the COVID period. It's like a dream come true because this is the first time I've been here with my son, too. So waiting a whole year and then finally being able to return to Dodger Stadium with my kid.
I'm feeling really happy right now because we're sharing a common interest of baseball and we're getting to watch what's hopefully going to be a really good game. So we're looking forward to that. And, of course, right here at the Dodger Dogs place, we're going to get an infamous Dodger Dog.
I can smell them. I know that's going to be good. Is that something you guys usually do, or have you ever gotten it before?
No, this is my first time.
George Sr. has been a season ticket holder for a decade now, and this experience of being able to root for a team all together under one roof, he thinks it's just as essential as the game itself.
All of these sports that, like, the Dodgers, the Lakers, the Clippers, these are spectator sports. And without spectators, you know, it just takes all the air out of the players. I'm sure they're going through the motions for TV and what have you, but it's the fans that they play for.
You can feel it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And the energy in the stadium, right? I mean, what's home field advantage? If you don't have fans, it means nothing.
Now, home field advantage during a pandemic means it's pretty unlikely you'll see anything more than a dot or two of Philly red and a sea of Dodger blue. But, of course, they are hard to miss.
I can't help but see you have on a Philly shirt, and I see some blue over here. What's going on?
Well, we live together. It was my best friend, my life partner.
We're roommates.
I'm just from Philly, and we both live in L.A. now, and we thought it'd be fun to have a little war together, see who wins.
And we wanted to get out of the house and really, you know, do something special together, and then we knew that they were playing together today, and what better way to ring in, like, COVID
Summer,
stuff.
I know, it's kind of the trifecta. The state is opening, it is the opening day, and your favorite teams are playing.
There you go.
So true, and it's beautiful out, too, on top of it.
Yeah, I'm here for the beer, too, so...
I'll let you get to that.
Okay, thanks, Tanya.
Thank you.
The crowd of over 52,000 fans released their pent-up celebrations not only for this occasion, but to make up for time lost. This was also a celebration for the Dodgers' 2020 World Series win. It also just so happened, after a whirlwind year and a half, Dodger announcer Tim Neverett had this opening night off.
I'm going to walk around the stadium. I'm going to go out to this center field plaza and check out how the fans are enjoying that. I'm going to have my mask on, so I'll be a little incognito, but that's okay. But I'm going to take it in and really enjoy it and put it in the memory banks.
The Dodgers play the Diamondbacks in Arizona on Saturday, and Neverett will announce from L.A. There's still some time before they can travel with the team. But Neverett believes this night makes the future look bright. Tim Neverett has written a book about this pandemic MLB season. It's called COVID Curveball, and it comes out in August. Well, scientists are investigating a phenomenon in Mexico that has transfixed people there for the past month. It's a giant sinkhole that opened up in May, and it just keeps growing. The pit has turned a tiny village into a tourist attraction, and as NPR's Carrie Kahn reports, nobody really knows why it's there.
It all started late last month at a small farm in the central Mexican state of Puebla. The ground under a large agricultural field gave way, and then gave way some more. Then the crowd started showing up and tweeting videos like this one, full of shrieks every time more and more land got sucked up into the hole. Just why the sinkhole, now more than 50 feet deep and nearly 500 feet wide, formed, no one has a definitive answer. Some point to the porous soil, others to excessive groundwater extraction from nearby factories and a controversial water bottling plant. Geophysicist Carlos Miguel Valdez of Mexico's National Autonomous University told Televisa that it's going to be hard to stop it from getting bigger.
La vibración, los vehículos, el camino,
all that activity around it now, the vibrations from the cars and people, it's all problematic, he says. Mexicans are fixated, though. They're writing songs about it and passing around memes on social media, like one with a soccer stadium built around the hole, or another with a giant Shrek bathing inside. National interest soared as the sinkhole edged closer toward a nearby house, soon swallowing the simple concrete block structure. When two local dogs playing near the ever-expanding edge fell in, the country was hooked. The two canines, Spy and Spike, were trapped in the hole's muddy depths for more than 72 hours. Under pressure from animal lovers and even a few Mexican film stars, rescue workers lowered a firefighter over the sheer cliffs and brought the two to safety. Spy's owner, Fatima Ortega Jimenez, told a local news station she's grateful to have her beloved pit bull back. I loved him before, but I'm going to love him two, three times more now that I have him back, she said. As for the owners of the house lost to the giant sinkhole, the governor says he'll relocate the family and help them build a new home. Carrie Kahn, NPR News, Mexico City.
This story aired previously on NPR. You're listening to Here and Now.
The new movie musical In the Heights, now in theaters and streaming on HBO Max. It's gotten plenty of media coverage and praise for its joyous representation of a Latin American neighborhood in New York City. But recently, In the Heights also has been criticized for leaving out the Black Hispanics who actually live in the Washington Heights neighborhood that the film depicts. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans has been following the controversy, and he joins us now. Hey, Eric.
Hi.
So Lin-Manuel Miranda, who created the original stage musical as well as the mega hit Hamilton, apologized for the movie's casting on Twitter. And here's what he said. I started writing In the Heights because I didn't feel seen. And it is clear that many in our dark-skinned Afro-Latino community don't feel sufficiently represented within it, particularly among the leading roles. So, Eric, this gets to the root charge against In the Heights, which is that it's guilty of colorism, privileging lighter-skinned actors. Eric, what led up to this point?
Well, I guess what led up to this point is the film came out, and in particular, a writer for The Root, I think, began talking about the lack of darker-skinned Latinos. And frankly, you know, I watched it, and I noticed it right away. I mean, I love the film, but I was a little disappointed. And, you know, there is one Black character, but that Black character is an African-American and was conceived that way in the stage show and in the film. You know, it's a great movie, but it just has a bit of an asterisk on it because they really made a mistake with the casting.
So with that criticism comes the defense. Theater and Hollywood legend Rita Moreno, for example, has come to Lin-Manuel Miranda's defense. She was on The Late Show on Tuesday. Here's what she said.
There's a lot of people who are Puerto Rico, who are also from Guatemala, who are dark and who are also fair. We are all colors in Puerto Rico. Mm-hmm. And this is how it is. And it would be so nice if they hadn't come up with that and left it alone just for now. I mean, they're really attacking the wrong person.
Eric, I mean, she did backtrack on those comments later on Twitter. She applauded Lin-Manuel Miranda's, quote, resolve to be more inclusive of the Afro-Latino community going forward. Eric, I'm wondering what you make of these two public apologies, Miranda's and Moreno's.
Well, you know, what it shows is that ultimately this kind of happened the way it should have. You know, Lin-Manuel Miranda apologized pretty quickly. His apology was already public before Rita Moreno said what she said. And then Rita realized that she had made a mistake and she apologized. And through the back and forth, the talk about colorism kind of came to the fore. And there may be a lot of people who don't realize that there is colorism within communities of color. I'm African American. I've seen it in the Black community. This just tells you a lot more about how we have to discuss these issues and be sensitive about them. And I assure you that Lin-Manuel Miranda is going to be thinking more about colorism when he goes to make his next project, whatever it is.
Yeah, you're making me think about how difficult it can be to have these nuanced conversations. Sometimes it can feel as if good guys like Lin-Manuel Miranda should either be off limits to criticism or they should be
canceled.
Sounds
like you're about to bring up something that I was involved with.
Yeah, well, you know where I'm going. I have to ask you about it, Eric, while I have you here. You wrote a very provocative column this week called Tom Hanks is a non-racist. It's time for him to be anti-racist. It was supposed to be thought-provoking, but it was misconstrued, shall we say, by Fox News commentators who said you wanted to cancel Tom Hanks. So for folks who may have seen that but not read the actual column, could you clarify? What were you actually saying?
Sure. So Tom Hanks wrote an essay for a guest essay for the New York Times where he said, you know, he hadn't found out about the Tulsa race massacre until last year. He was concerned that stories like that about the oppression of black people had been kept out of history classes. He said that Hollywood has often done this too. And he even said that some projects of his may have done that. And so I wrote a column where I pointed out how much I admire him and what a great actor I think he is and what a great public person I think he is and how great the essay is. But I said, you know, he needed to go a step further because if you're somebody who's a powerful actor who can get movies made, there's a lot you can do as an anti-racist to change the very thing that Tom Hanks described in his essay. And I thought it was kind of odd that he didn't take that extra step and say, here's what I'm going to do. So Fox News got a hold of that, and they said that I was trying to cancel Tom Hanks, and that just produced this deluge of really abusive criticism of me when I was basically trying to say, Tom, this is great, but here's the next step. And we should be able to have that conversation without having that being misconstrued as some attempt to cancel somebody or end their career or harm them. Because I don't understand how you could read my column with a fair mind and conclude that I was trying to do that. I was urging Tom Hanks to make more movies and TV shows. I don't want him canceled. I want him to do more.
I think the key, Eric, is just to not actually read the column. But Eric, thank you for setting the record straight and for talking about In the Heights with us as well. That's NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Thank you.
And I officially say, read the column.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Callum Borchers.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.